Hey, how's it going, folks? It's Abdullah.
And Bean.
And welcome back for another episode of Great Moments in Weed History. Now, if this is your first time listening on this podcast, Bean and I talk about some of the more interesting points in the very, very long history of cannabis. We are both cannabis journalists and media makers, and we've spent chunks of our lives obsessing over and studying the wonders of cannabis. And on this show, we get to talk about some of the moments that led up to our cannabis present. You should know that I have no prior knowledge of anything we're about to talk about. Bean has done all the research. He's going to be telling me the story, and I'm going to chime in. We're going to smoke some weed. We're going to have some tea. It's going to be fun. So hang out with us, and we're going to get into it. Bean, what do you got for us today?
Today's story is really all about resiliency, which I think is actually something we learn right from the plant. I've seen some weed plants that were really mistreated, nobody turned the lights on for a while, or they didn't get, it's a hardy plant, you know, it grows. It is truly a weed, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, historically, the resilience of cannabis as a plant and the adaptability of cannabis as a plant is what led early human beings to carry it all over the place with them, to take it to new places, to plant the seeds. You know, you could rely on the fact that it would actually grow in a lot of different climates. You know, hemp, which a lot of people think is a different plant than the flowering cannabis that we use to get psychoactive flowers from, but it's not. In fact, it's the same plant, just adapted to a different environment. So yeah, I'm all about the resilience of cannabis, man.
Yeah, and of our culture and how we kept this going through the dark days of Prohibition to ultimately win. This story's got a little bit of all of that.
Great metaphor, Bean.
Oh, thank you. I came up with it a long time ago, while we were just sitting down right now to
that's
record.
One from the vault. Yeah. Tight. Okay, sick. So what are we talking about?
Are we ready to?
I think we might be. Ready? I've got a J all twisted up
here. You've got a J all twisted up? All right. Well, if you're not quite there, hit pause and roll one up or pack one up or do what you want to do, because we're ready to journey back in time to another
great moment in weed history.
You know, it's no exaggeration to say this podcast runs on coffee and weed. And lately, the coffee has been top shelf because of our new sponsor, Vigilante Coffee. I grind my beans daily, no pun intended, and I do the whole pretentious hipster pour over thing every morning. And I gotta say, I really enjoy thinking about where my coffee came from and how it was grown and processed, just like weed. And just like weed, it's worth it to get the best coffee you can afford. And the good news is, if you brew your own at home, really good coffee is an affordable luxury. That's why I'm thrilled to have Vigilante Coffee on the podcast and in my mug each and every morning. Vigilante is a specialty coffee roaster that sources their beans directly from small, award-winning farms around the world and then roasts them to perfection. They support ending the war on drugs, and they want to support this podcast too, because they believe that all you really need is coffee and weed. Amen. So treat yourself to a bag of their Golden Bean award-winning Dank blend, which has just returned for its fourth year. Dank is 80% Guatemalan and 20% Ethiopian. Brew that up nice and strong and pair it with a puff or two of good weed in the morning, and I guarantee you will be up and at them. To learn more or to order their amazing coffee, check out their website, vigilantecoffee.com, or you can visit one of their cafes. And if you buy a pound of those beans, well, please tell them Bean sent you. vigilantecoffee.com.
So, Bean, what are we talking about today?
All right, well, this is a story about somebody I've actually known for, almost over 10 years now. And I'll just get into the story and we'll go from there. The first time I interviewed Robert Platschorn, this was back in 2005,
Our phone call kept getting interrupted by a recorded voice on the line reminding me that I was talking with a federal inmate.
Oh, wow. So this is somebody who was in prison, I'm assuming for cannabis based on the nature of this show.
Good assumption. Yeah, this is back when I was a reporter for High Times, and I got an email from a guy, and he said there was a cover story in 1981 about my father. He's still in prison, and he is supposed to be let out, and the parole board is refusing to hear his case. And would you talk to him and write an article?
And it was for cultivating trafficking. What was the nature of the crime?
Smuggling.
Smuggling.
Yeah, we are in that like 70s, going back to when he got arrested, and his whole operation was sort of that golden era of smuggling in. You know, U.S. homegrown weed wasn't really a thing. No one had created the hybrid strains that would grow well here. So you had these guys going down to Mexico, the Caribbean, South America.
Yeah, you know, smuggling weed in bulk is kind of an arcane concept in the United States in some ways because it's become so available in so many different places. But if you've seen the movie Blow, for example, you know, the story of George Young, you know, before he got into Blow, I mean, a big chunk of the movie is him smuggling cannabis, right? He's smuggling cannabis from Mexico, perhaps, into the United States. And, you know, and that's how he's doing business because that's where you got the weed from. You know what I mean? If you wanted to have that supply, you had to find a route to move it into the country first, you know?
Yeah, and these were the early days. As you know, as we're going to hear in this story, interdiction at the border was also just starting. So it was not the drug war as we know it now. It was a lot of these guys were what we would think of as really small-time operators, including Robert Platcher. And he was it was in this era. And what ultimately happens is when you crack down on the little guys and you make it this serious crime, well, then you go from that to the cocaine cowboys era, because cocaine is much more lucrative. If you're going to risk a big prison sentence for anything, it's way easier to smuggle cocaine. It's much more profitable. And the big organized criminal entities, they have the wherewithal to do that. And it pushes out all these sort of small-time smugglers.
Right. So Platchorn, am I saying his name right? Mm-hmm. So Platchorn was dealing with dozens of pounds, hundreds of pounds. Like, how much weed is he actually moving?
I mean, hundreds. You know, I've that makes you a small timer in the grand scheme of things. It's a way more weed than I've ever seen in one place.
A weed was weaker back then.
Oh, you should have been his lawyer. Yeah, you could have gotten him out in like six.
This weed is weak. I smoked a half pound of this weed on the way over here, so it's all relative. You know,
I have like a little headache.
Yeah, that's a great argument, actually.
Well, that and a time machine, I'm sure could help. So yeah, at the time he's trying to get out, and all told, he served 29 years in prison for a first-time nonviolent offense.
Damn, that's crazy. Just for cannabis. So hey, listen up, kids. You know, I mean, and a lot of people now who you do live in places, perhaps, you know, if you're listening to this, perhaps you do live in a place where the laws are so draconian that you could get into that much trouble. But, you know, it's again, there's like, you know, in the United States or in a place like California or in a lot of places in the U.S. right now, no one can imagine those types of sentences. And in fact, I mean, right next door to California in Arizona, you know, people get locked up for weed for years, you know, for like a half a joint. So where was he exactly?
He's a Philly guy. So
no,
I know
get
you got
it.
Philly roots, but he's working out of South Florida.
Yeah, just a special shout out to, you know, all the Philadelphia Eagle fans out there who are blazing trees and listening to this right now. We did it.
So I talked to him. He's still trying to get out, and what he told me was, you know, his plan was to get out of prison as soon as he could. He wanted to go fishing with his son, who he hadn't seen since he was 4 years old. and he wanted to publish his memoirs, which he'd been writing over the course of 30 years on these like battered prison typewriters whenever he was allowed access to
it. My God. So he was in federal prison. So this was like state line stuff.
Yeah. He was in federal prison the entire time. Sometimes he was in maximum security places. He told me about different like mob family bosses that he knew, like working in the, he told me it was one story about like he was working in the kitchen and it was him and I won't say who it was, but a recognizable mafia name, at least if you know that sort of stuff. But he said every night they'd have the same conversation. Because if you worked in the kitchen, you'd get to cook a little meal for yourself at the end of the day. And it'd be him and this guy where, like, the guys run in the kitchen because they'd been there forever. This was a choice job, you know?
Right.
You'd get to cook a little meal just for the little kitchen crew. Every day, well, what do you want to make? And Platt Shorten would say, I don't know, this or that. And he'd go, all right, well, I was thinking pasta fazool. And then he'd go, right. You know what? Pasta fazool. You're exactly right. Yeah. That's what we should have.
All right, so anyhow, so
yeah, so he does eventually get out. It still took years after the first time I talked to him battling the parole board, but he gets out and he needs to figure out how to get back on his feet. He's got this memoir that he wrote, but you know, he's looking to do something, and he goes back onto the pitchman circuit. Which is what he used to do, like Chop-O-Matic. And
like a television pitchman, like Willie Mays.
Yes, exactly.
Billy Mays. Billy Mays was the baseball
he
player.
He knew him, and they were like a small crew of people. He didn't do it on TV. He did it at events.
Ah, okay. Yeah, sure. I've seen this sort of thing. Like, there's a guy standing there with, like, just the hood of a car. You know what I mean? And he, like, hits it with a hammer, and then, like, he's like, check it out, good as new, you know?
Yeah, and he could do all kinds of, like, fancy chopping and garnish vegetables into shapes, and he's, like, a good-looking, charismatic guy back in the day, so...
And this is his post-prison life here.
After 30 years away, there were people who remembered him from that world and were like, yeah, dude, if you can move units... We'll take you back if you can't move units.
Oh, so he was actually in this game before he went into prison.
Yes, this was his game before.
Oh, I see. So he was already pretty experienced, but I mean, being out of the game for that long, you would assume the industry would have moved on.
Yeah, know? Well, they were just, that was their deal. They were like, if people buy it, you're hired. If you go out there and don't sell, you know, nothing for you. And he could still crush it.
And he still had the stuff. Okay, cool. So he gets out, and it's not the worst situation for someone just out of federal prison after a long time. He has some success.
Yeah, and he was very successful at this before he went to prison. So I asked him, like, you know, why? How did you get into smuggling weed?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what, you know, would make you become a big smuggler? You already, you know, had your shit together. And he was not young, not that young when he started smuggling.
I mean, to tell you the truth, that feels like it's kind of part of the premise of the story, right? Is that a guy who's a TV pitchman goes to jail, you know? How come you didn't mention that sooner?
I got a little lost.
Okay, it's all good. It happens. Okay, cool. So basically, I mean, he was a pitchman, right? Who, for some reason, ended up getting into weed smuggling. Why the hell did he do it in the first place?
Yeah, so I asked him that, and he said it was the atmosphere of the 70s. You talk to people from that were, like, heads in the 70s. It was wild.
Yeah, you hear about, you know, the indulgence or the, you know, the levels of just the volumes of drugs that are, you know, like, moving around. But, I mean, if you're moving hundreds of pounds of weed, it doesn't seem like the kind of thing that would incidentally happen. I mean, okay, if they find, like, an ounce of weed in your car or something, that's like it was the 70s. You know what I mean? It's like
true.
Moving hundreds of pounds of weeds, that's not like, oh, it was the 70s, right? Yeah. I mean, like, but what was, I mean, did he have any more of an explanation for it?
Yeah, so he said, the first time somebody came to me and said, I have 500 pounds, do you know anybody who wants it? That was a very attractive proposition. He's also like a wheeler dealer kind of guy.
Right. So he was just enticed by the thing that entices everyone who gets into the drug game, weed game, whatever it is, selling illegal stuff. It's a hustle. You know what I mean? If you're a hustler, you're going to be into it.
Yeah. And then he said, you know, at that time, then this is true. the average first offender, even for big weight crimes like that, would get 3 to 5 years, and usually that would be a suspended sentence. I never thought anyone was serious about putting people away for a long time for marijuana. I honestly thought pot was going to be legalized in a couple of years. This was like the Carter years.
Right.
You know, and I figured this was no big deal.
Yeah, this is such a familiar thing, kind of. And I mean, definitely the first card you want to play if you ever get in trouble for a lot of something is be like, oh, I had no idea this was prohibited. You go to jail for this? Oh, dear God, officer. If I had known that, I never would have gotten into this.
You know, honestly, that explains a few things. Because this stuff seems popular, but I never see it in stores or advertised on television, so... Mm-hmm.
But indeed, playing the ignorance card was not going to work for Plathorn in this situation, unfortunately. And, I mean, that's crazy because we're talking about a time when there was draconian federal weed laws, but a lot of these measures, a lot of these, like, sort of sentences are still happening, you know what I mean? Like, there's still pretty hefty sentences being handed down by the federal government for trafficking cannabis.
And there's still people inside for a long time, you know. One of the great things about legalization as it passed in California is, you know, there is a mechanism by which to get released, to have your record expunged. Some big cities have just gone ahead and expunged records without you even having to do anything. So, you know, that is something we really need to keep in mind as we keep legalizing.
Yeah, and San Francisco recently threw out, all the small cannabis convictions, right? And I mean, like, or perhaps all of them, I don't know, but it makes sense, you know, like, the cannabis being included with the prohibited drugs that really carry hefty sentences is a very politicized consequence of a lot of economic bullshit, really. You know what I mean? But anyhow, so Plathorn.
Yeah, so most people are getting like a suspended sentence for smuggling. Somebody comes to him and says, hey, I know where to get 500 pounds. He likes adventure and risk. He says, what the hell? And what happens is, this is right around the time the DEA is forming. Not a friend of the podcast.
Not.
And they've got this operation going in South Florida called Operation Banco. It's their first time looking into pot smuggling. They've spent tons of money on this operation, and they haven't caught anybody that they can prosecute. You know who they have caught that they can't prosecute in South Florida?
Who? Plathorn?
No. They prosecute the shit out of him. The big operators that they find through this investigation are all people who are like the old anti-communist Cubans that the CIA probably killed Kennedy with.
Ah, okay, gotcha. Sure.
So they keep having to throw them back and not prosecute them, and now they've got this big budget spent and nobody to show for it, no arrests. So
essentially, the DEA was assembled to target like drugs coming in from Cuba, like, or whatever, like overseas, right?
That's a big part of their mission. That's not their entire.
But that came to nothing, essentially.
This whole operation, they said, we know all this weed's coming into South Florida, and it was. I mean, that's where tons. You know, it's the 70s, so it's going from not that many people smoking pot to a lot of people smoking a lot of pot. Right. It's got to come from somewhere. It doesn't grow well in the U.S. yet. And South Florida becomes this place where it's coming in. And so the DEA goes to look and like, who's doing this? How is so much? It doesn't add up to them. And then they realize it's like these people that are anti-communists, people who had been part of like the CIA's campaign against Cuba and the Bay of Pigs and like all these sort of mercenary people that have long CIA ties, so they can't prosecute them because they could basically be like, oh, you're going to prosecute me. I'll just talk about how we killed Kennedy.
Right. Gotcha. Okay. So that's a big side story. But yeah, so essentially now they've come up with no examples, no sort of, you know, no one to turn into the poster kid for, you know, serious drug charges, essentially.
Yeah. And then the next thing that happens is the IRS and Customs. See, Customs, that used to be their turf, who's coming in and bringing stuff in. So they see the DEA spending all this money, and they start investigating the DEA, which is a very new organization at this point. It's only a couple of years old. This is like their first thing, and it's failing. So, of course, they decide, we got to find somebody to take the fall.
Right. And Platchorn is an easy scapegoat right now, and he's in their clutches.
They clutch him. So, you know, nobody doubts that him and his crew were moving serious weight. But compared to the big time smuggling rings at the time, they're like little fish.
But they threw the book at him.
But, you know, he had a good time doing it. Like, it's this sort of golden era ending with his bust, because before there were these heavy prison sentences, it attracted, like, you know, people who were just swashbucklers, you know, and this is his description of, like, a little bit more of his mindset of why he was attracted to this smuggling life. Like, do you know, you must know people who are, like, fully on that other side of the law, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you know, it's interesting that so many of those people are now involved in, like, the legal cannabis industry. You know what I mean? But yeah, of course. I mean, there's, like, there's a lot of people who run into this shit in high school. I mean, I had friends who would, you know, get nabbed for this kind of stuff and for just small amounts of weed, right? And the funny thing was, it's, like, essentially in the same category as all these other things. Like, you almost would rather get caught fist fighting. You'd rather get arrested for fist fighting with somebody than you would smoking a joint with somebody outside a bar, right? Which is a crazy thing to think about, because, like, you know, fist fighting someone is, that's really terrible. You're, you know, exacting violence on someone else in public. You know what I mean? But if a cop catches you doing that, he's just going to break you up and be like, all right, no broken bones, no, like, you know, heavy bleeding. Just, all right, just shake hands and walk on home, right? If two guys are smoking the joint, the cop's going to be like, that's it, you're going down. You know what I mean? That's such a fucked up thing. But that's, you know, that's really the crux of, like, you know, the issue when it comes to nonviolent offenders.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's sort of brilliant, because I love those, that, like, meme where it shows, like, oh, alcohol does this, and it's the guy puking his guts out, and then the other side is, like, you know, two people, you know, a guy happily smoking a joint and, like, chilling or whatever. And it makes a good point. But, like, your thing as a meme, as a split screen, is, like, it's not about weed. It's about enforcement and authoritarian mindset. And, like,
Yeah.
It's obvious, but, like, it's such a clear vision.
Isn't that funny? Yeah. I should write that down. I'm glad we're recording.
Yeah. Oh, are we?
Yeah.
Did we start?
Yeah, no, this is still the...
Oh,
this is
fuck,
the,
you should have said.
Yeah, oh, is this the practice run we do before every episode? We just rehearse all this shit. We're just reading this off teleprompters. It's, you know, it's like
you're not
scrolling.
Supposed to say anything.
It's okay. Oh, we control the edit.
Oh, yeah. Totally. And we won't let this slip through.
No, not at all. No one will ever hear this. Blah, 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 blah. Fuck everybody.
I'm going to denounce some people who don't even know that I dislike them, starting in alphabetical order.
Aaron A. Aronson.
Oh,
fuck,
he's
you.
God, Aronson. Hit stop, because I don't even want my words in your ears. Yeah. All right, now that he's gone, you want to hear him describing the romance of the smuggler lifestyle?
Yeah.
This is fun. This is from an interview that I did with him.
Awesome.
So he said, smuggling weed was great back when we dealt with nice people who were fun to be around and did not have guns.
That sounds like a magical time. You know what I mean? And a time that we're kind of returning to. Thankfully, it's nice that, you know, guns and cannabis are, like, parting ways again. You know, now with, like, cannabis liberalization. But there was a time, like, yeah, once again, man, you're a drug dealer dealing in any kind of drug, guns are part of the game.
Yeah, but that's how sort of innocent this was back in the day.
It was the 70s. That's still the best. Like, they're like, sir, like, you were caught, like, you know, you stole 76 classic cars. And he's like, it was the 80s. You know what I mean? You're like, well, yeah, I guess. Like, get out of here, you scamp.
Yeah, even to extend your metaphor, it's like a cop finds that ounce in your glove box or a gun. I'm sure 80% of the cops out there, like, look at you harder if you've got an ounce in your glove compartment.
That's an interesting thing, that in a lot of places in the United States to this day, you would rather get caught with a gun in your glove compartment than a bag of weed by the police. That's fucking insane to think about, too. And if you're in one of those states, tell us what that's like. Email us, tweet at us, because we're curious.
I remember. All too well. This is him talking about his life in those days. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea how it feels to be at the controls of an old DC-3 flying through a mountain pass near Santa Marta in Colombia?
Oh, so he was deep in the game. I mean, he was flying around in small planes in Colombia.
Yeah, not even that small of a plane, but a small plane, yeah. Your instructions are to go over a picturesque little town with a church steeple at 10,000 feet, then drop down at 2,000 feet and follow a stream to a remote airstrip where the cows scatter in every direction as you put your wheels down.
Crazy.
It's early in the morning, the sun is shining, the Andes are so gorgeous, and at the far end of the runway, a huge truck's waiting for you, filled up with bales of the best bud you've ever smoked in your life.
It's interesting. I wonder what kind of cannabis we're talking about here. I mean, like, specifically, I'd be so curious to see, like, a picture of, or just get a scratch and sniff, you know what I mean, of what that stuff must have been like. It's, you know, tropical equatorial weed, right?
Yeah, it's definitely sativa. It was literally called Santa Marta Gold. And at the time, like now we have like the hot new strains come out.
Right.
It's all about breeding, right? Like what's, as we're sitting here now, what's like the current hot strain, you think?
I don't know. You see a lot of like gelato is always around a lot. Purple Punch is kind of like a strain still. I feel like that's dope. You know what I mean? But yeah.
Well, in the 70s, the equivalent is like some person would go to a new place like Colombia or Mexico or Jamaica and get a supply that was big enough to bring in enough that people started talking about, you know, Punta Roja and Acapulco Gold. And one of them that you would hear about is this strain he was bringing in, Santa Marta Gold, from Santa Marta in Colombia. There's definitely pictures of it on the internet. Scratch and sniff. I don't know.
Sadly. But that's amazing. So he's in kind of weed heaven right now. You know what I mean? Plathorn is, he's kicking it. He's, you know, in this beautiful landscape. And there's a truckload of really dank-ass weed sitting there waiting for him.
Yeah. And to both our question of like, well, how do you start doing this?
Yeah.
After listening to him say that, if he was like, all right, I'm going to go get in the plane now. Do you want to go? I'd be like, yeah.
Yeah, right? Eventually. You're like, that sounds like an incredible adventure. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And he really stressed like, and this is something that's been my experience is just as a weed journalist, is how cool the people that he met was and how much he liked the whole vibe of the scene at that time. And that's definitely how I feel about weed people.
Yeah, weed people are generally pretty cool. I mean, yeah, I've definitely been in sketchy weed situations in various countries, but that's because, I think that results because weed is, you know, forced into like the shadows, like, you know, through this sort of Eurocentric Western-led prohibition in like other places. And, you know, that's why it becomes a part of the seedy element of whatever culture. But otherwise, I mean, by and large, if you're with people who are constantly using cannabis, look, this is kind of an empathy-inducing substance. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to be more amenable to, you know, relating to another person if you're stoned. And that's a great thing about being a cannabis user, because if you, like, you know, see somebody out there in the world and you give them the old international symbol, you know what I mean? You've made a new friend instantly. Yeah. It's a great thing. Yeah.
And yeah, so he says it was all romantic as hell back in those 70s.
I bet.
But all of that collapsed when the DEA made it very clear that they were going to treat pot smuggling as a very serious crime.
Right.
So
he's fucked.
He's fucked and he doesn't know it. He stopped smuggling like a year before they come to get him.
No kidding. So meaning they had basically been watching him for a long time and had collected evidence on him.
Yes. And they wanted to get the big guys, kept realizing they couldn't get the big guys for political reasons.
They went back into the old files and were like, all right, who do we got that we can pin?
It's the files that fucking kill you.
Cops. The cops, the cops enter an episode of Great Moments in Weed History with a nice little...
Yeah, not going to be the heroes of too many of these tales. So they raid him and like 11 other people from the operation. His wife also is in jail for just a little while. And they make this into like, this is the first time they turn prosecuting a drug crime into like a media spectacle, where there's press conferences and those like pictures of, look at all this stuff we did, and, you know, really kind of trying this guy in the press to make it seem like he's a big deal when he's really not.
Right. So, I mean, this is classic police behavior. You know what I mean? Seeing that they're far more in it for the glory or the political gain than for the actual benefit of enforcement. If you've ever seen The Wire, this is nothing new to you, right? It's like you see that the commissioner, all the people, you know, the police, you know, as an institution, as an organization, is a political entity. It's not like actually they're designed, it's not designed to like serve and protect, like it says on the side of a car. The same way that the water utility, like, you know, fucks up half the time because it's underfunded and it's run by stupid people. I mean, that's pretty much every, like, you know, that's, you could apply that to the police department as well, I think, in most cases. So here, you know, Platshorn is the unwitting patsy in a situation. A guy who has committed a crime technically on the books, but a patsy nonetheless, because he's not serving time for his crimes that he committed. He's serving time for the failures of law enforcement to actually do their job in the first place.
Yeah, he's part of their PR campaign. And that's really what it comes down to.
And he's not getting paid for it.
No. No, he's not. They call him the part of the biggest and slickest weed smuggling ring in U.S. history. That's a quote. They bring out the Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organizations Act, RICO, as it's better known.
Oh, yeah, of course, RICO, yeah.
So this is designed, again, to go after these, like, big crime families, and they're using it against this guy and his buddies.
Wow. And dude, that is insane. So, I mean, you know, that's just one of so many infuriating stories like this of, you know, people getting busted for weed. But this one is especially bad because that sentence is pretty fucking insane. That's a chunk of someone's life, you know?
Yeah. And this is, you know, they're running this PR campaign and they're also sending a message like punishment will be completely disproportionate to the crime. And that continues. And that is how we get to this mass incarceration place in our society with, you know, privately run for-profit prisons, all of this. The DEA is new. This sort of drug war industrial complex as we know it now is forming and becoming a model that they're going to spread to the rest of everything over this time. So what Platshorn says is, yeah, you know, we made a modest amount of money, but not even 1% of what was alleged at our trial. The government claimed we brought in up to 3 million pounds, but in reality, they only had 100,000 pounds. That's no small amount.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, 100,000 is a lot. Like, you figure that's like, I mean, that's a career of runs. You know what I mean? But 3 million is like, you think of 3 million, and that's not humanly possible by like a small crew of dudes.
Yeah.
You know, in a matter of years, moving 3 million pounds of weed is going to take infrastructure. So that's pretty ridiculous to assume that, you know, Blatchorn's, you know, crew is capable of that.
Yeah. He says, in total, we made 3 flights and a boat trip, and all of a sudden, we're the biggest thing that ever hit marijuana. And to your point, like, the only people who have that kind of infrastructure are going to be the cartels. They're building the cartels. It's not drugs that made the drug cartels. It's drug prohibition that made the drug cartels.
Right. Yeah, of course, because, I mean, that demand remains steady or spikes up, you know, every time this enforcement attempts to, like, you know, it's like, it's like water, you know, coming into, like, a ship in a sense, right? Like, meaning, like, it's like the drug physics are tell you that those drugs are coming in one way or another. You can, you plug one hole, it's going to come in through another hole faster. You know what I mean? And the, it's not the best analogy because in the end, you know, you let all the water in the wheat and the ship sinks, but shipwrecks are cool. But yeah, I mean, the point being that we all know that the enforcement methodology doesn't really work. You know what I mean? Because it has given us the state of things today. We all know what the drug war results in, right? So cops are dumb. Wow, we always come back to that point, don't we? Seems to come up a lot in this show, but yeah, the fucking cops are really taking advantage of this poor bastard.
Yeah, and the other point that he makes is, like, you get to jail, and there's weed in jail, and there's other drugs in jail. So what is society, how hard, locked down of a world are we going to live in to actually stop drugs from being the water that gets into that ship in your metaphor? So
yeah.
But lo these many years, he gets out in 2008. And he goes back to being a pitch man, and he publishes his memoirs, which are called Black Tuna Diaries, which are really fun. And he's out at the Seattle Hemp Fest giving a speech talking about his old smuggling days, and the crowd is with him, and he's a great speaker, you know, as a pitch man. And he told me, I had this realization, like, all these people already love weed. They don't need to hear from me. But now he's old now. He's a senior citizen by the time he gets out.
Right.
And he's like, I should be telling senior citizens that cannabis is great for a lot of the problems that you get as you get older, and no one's talking to them. So he forms this organization called the Silver Tour, and he starts, like, basically going from one retirement community to another as a speaker, and he's like, as soon as I start talking to them, they're down.
Yeah?
Yeah, people who, like, their whole lives were against it.
Dude, that's crazy. And, I mean, I think that's, you know, that signals the sea change. Look, in the time the Blatchorn was in prison, a lot changed. You know, and I think that, you know, when we look at the huge shift, you know, the change in acceptance of cannabis, you know, you've seen the polls swing in essentially 20 years. Really, it's a demographic shift in that a lot of the people who were subject to all the propaganda, very effective propaganda that ran for decades, right? Very concerted effort in the United States and a lot of, like, you know, European countries, et cetera. Those people are dying off. That's literally what's happening. So in that 30 years, right, like, meaning those people died off, and people who grew up in the, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, times when the media was more accepting, wink, wink, nudge, nudge about cannabis. Bill Clinton, oh, I did not inhale. You know, the president is saying that he, like, puffed a joint at some point. You know, like, a lot changed, and a lot changed because a lot of people with really screwed up views on cannabis died. It continues to happen. Like literally like 10 years from now, 1 year from now, that percentage of people who are for the liberalization of cannabis on a at a federal level in the United States is going to tick up just a little bit more because some of your grandmas and grandpas died. But that's just the fact of the matter. You know what I mean? So Platshorn gets out of prison. When he goes into prison, it's like fucking drugs are bad. You know what I mean? Drugs are real, real bad.
He goes in at this hard turn from sort of the Carter administration in the 70s and thinking it was going to be legalized. Mm-hmm. By the time he's prosecuted, it's the Reagan administration and it's very clearly going the other way.
Yeah, seriously. Suddenly, like, you know, the war on drugs is stepped up. Continues to be stepped up, you know, with Bush 1. No hope for change. Kind of continues to be stepped up through Clinton, too. You know what I mean? Like, Clinton Absolutely. Did not exactly curb the war on drugs. In fact, the prison population ballooned under the Clinton administration. So, I mean, whatever. Not to get too in the weeds with, like, American politics. But look, the times change. You know?
Well, we'll have that discussion on In the Weeds, our new political podcast, yeah. Where we talk about everything politics while stoned.
Yeah, starting with a four-part, two-hour each episode special on the Clintons.
And the rise of the prison industrial complex. Yeah.
I would actually listen to that.
Yeah, actually, you want to do that?
Yeah, maybe we should do that. Yeah, that's not a bad idea. That's a really interesting premise for a podcast, to be like, literally, it starts like as soon as Clinton's elected. We should talk about that. That'd be cool.
So this is how he gets. And this is something that everybody should be for the most humanitarian reasons in the world. The older people in your life, whether you're yourself in that age bracket, or your parents or your grandparents, cannabis is a great medicine and. They're getting so much pharmaceuticals thrown at them that to make them at least aware of this other option is, I think, really important.
Yeah, it's essential, you know? But yeah, so where are we at with Platshorn?
So this is what he does. He goes into these retirement homes. He goes into pitchman mode. He starts by telling his own story, which just like grips them right off the bat. Then he tells them all about the racist underpinnings of prohibition, which, as he says, just they don't know. They were the original people subjected to this propaganda.
Right. And they assumed it was truth. They believed what they read in the papers, in the Hearst papers, you know? And who can blame them? I mean, people believe everything they read in the news now. And most of the news is that other news is fake. You know?
Everybody's news is real and everybody else's news is fake to somebody.
It's very confusing time. Everything you hear here is real news, you should know.
Absolutely. And so he tells them all about the government lies. He brings in a doctor to talk about it as a medicine. He brings in a patient, somebody who has successfully, an older person, who has successfully used cannabis as a medicine. He talks about how the different prescription drugs that can be replaced or reduced with cannabis.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and by the end, he's got them ready to try it. He's got them ready to write to their... It ends with them all writing letters to their representatives. And he's just, you know... He was a big part of getting medical cannabis passed in Florida.
No kidding. Like, so that was pretty recently. I mean, this is like, that's his post-prison work there. So while he's a pitch man and stuff, he's also working on this shit.
Yeah. And, you know, he's got his book sales and he does some writing and he does these events and, you know, he cobbles together, you know, he's on Social Security, obviously, you know, he's over 65. And,
right.
And he's just tireless as an activist.
He's still hustling.
What's so amazing to me is like, he's still got a sense of humor. He's still like optimistic. He still believes in the humanity of people. You know, he's somebody of all the people that I've ever reported on that really inspires me. That, like we said, I said at the beginning, that resiliency, I think.
Yeah, seriously.
And he has been, he took this on the road. He's brought groups of seniors to Washington, D.C. to lobby the government, to lobby the State House in Florida. He's been covered in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, on CNN. And I don't know if you ever saw it, but there was a Daily Show segment called Old Tokes Home.
No, I never saw that. All right. So so what happened with him?
Well, you know, that's he's living in Florida now where there is medical cannabis, which is wonderful. He's, you know, obviously free to do as he wants. He has his organization going. And I think kind of the really beautiful part of this is he is reunited with his high school sweetheart and wife from all the way back before he went in, went into prison.
Wow, get out of town. So they did they stay together for that 30 years, or they broke up and then ended up getting back together?
They you know, he said to her, I'm gonna be gone too long.
Right.
Know, live your life.
Oh, and man, that's rough. Yeah, but that's, you know, that's a noble thing to do. Shit, to be like, don't wait for me. I'm locked up on some bullshit for a chunk of my life.
Yeah. And then when he got out, she really just kind of said, well, you can stay with me. You don't have anywhere to stay. And love bloomed. And
oh, that's fucking great, man. Well, good for Plathorn. Holy shit. Is that the end of his story?
Yeah. He's a good dude.
Yeah. And he's still chilling. He's still out there in Florida hanging out, smoking weed medically.
He is one of the more tireless freedom fighters for cannabis that I know to this day.
Amazing, man. Well, that's incredible. You know, Plathorn's story makes me remember that there are so many unsung heroes of cannabis. You know, people who have fought for the liberalization of cannabis and have lost so much themselves, you know, as a result. Look, we're talking about a guy who gave up half his life, you know, and look, when he entered prison, you know, maybe he was just getting busted for something that, you know, excited him or something he was into. But his incarceration really, you know, turned him into an activist. Look, now he's out there bringing medical cannabis to a place that, I mean, by any estimation, would have taken a really long time to adopt medical cannabis in Florida. It's a pretty conservative place. You know what I mean? So that's quite an accomplishment. So shout out to you, Plathorn. Glad to hear you're still chilling out there. Hope you're listening to this and smoking a fat one. And thanks on behalf of Great Moments in Weed History. And that about wraps it up for this episode of Great Moments in Weed History. Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and leave us a nice little review if you're so inclined. And follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and SoundCloud at GMIWH Podcast. And please give us a tweet or a post if you like the show. And with that, we'll close it out. Thanks so much. We'll see you next week.
Well, that's the show, folks. Thanks so much for listening. And if you stuck around this long, please consider supporting us on Patreon. You could put $5 on it at greatmomentsinweedhistory.com. And that would really help us as we research, write, edit, and publish a new episode every Wednesday. Great Moments in Weed History is written, produced, and performed by me, David Bienenstock, aka Bean. Special thanks to our sponsor, PAX. Go to PAX.com and use promo code GREATMOMENTS, all one word, for a big discount at checkout.